From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Sylvia Maria Gross is away this week. On this week's show, while the mayor of Kansas City gives his State of the City address, residents weigh in with their own assessments.
Well, the State of the City right now, it's nice weather, so that's the best part about it.
And hear how the city expects to pay for its many priorities.
They really don't want the employees to have a third year without any raises. How do you do that with very limited revenue growth?
Plus, child harmonica prodigy Brody Buster has a new career and a new album.
You know, if I wrote anything on the last albums, it was written under supervision of people that were in the band, you know. Everything on this I wrote on my own.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith, filling in for Sylvia Maria Gross. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Kansas City Mayor Sly James gives his assessment of the state of the city in an address at Bartle Hall on Monday. But how are residents rating KC life? Casey Currents' Carrie Coogan hits the streets in Westport and Midtown to find out.
Well, the state of the city right now, it's nice weather, so that's the best part about it. I'm glad we didn't have a really bad winter because the city is not very good for taking care of our streets. And my street happens to be one of those streets where we really never get the city to take care of it. My name is Patrick Jay, and I live on West Plaza. Crime is one of the biggest problems we have here, and I really do not like the idea that we can't get that under control.
Well, I was raised in Kansas City, and then I moved away, and now I'm back, and it's grown quite a bit. A lot of development with Kauffman Center, Performing Arts Center, downtown, all the lofts and condos, restaurants, Power and Light District, and Plaza seems to be doing well still, so it's fun so far.
I actually think that our economy in Kansas City is turning around. And the education, yes, I'm very concerned about that, but we will be sending our children to private schools. But I am worried about the school because I don't know what's going to happen. And I don't know if it would be better if the state does finally take it over, but something really needs to be done with that.
Well, I mean, overall, I think it's pretty decent. I think one of the biggest concerns that most of us have is just the lack of jobs right now and the fact that it's really hard just to make it. I mean, as an everyday person, you know, I'm actually on my way to go do applications. So I really think the lack of jobs is the biggest thing that is one of the main concerns. I mean, because honestly, I'm 24 and I got out of the military. And I mean, there's not really many opportunities for me considering that what I chose to do doesn't offer me any jobs out here in the civilized world, if you will.
I'm Beatrice, and I'm 9, and I live in Kansas City. I like it more than, like, the country because you can go to different places, and there's a lot of stuff to do.
I think the city's improving right now. There's still a lot of work out there that needs to be done, but I think that there's a general feeling of positiveness around the city of where we're going. I think obviously one of the major problems is still the murder rate that's going on there, which is too high. And there's just, we're very focused at times on our own communities. There's obviously a divide in this city, whether it be along Prospect, the Paseo, or along Troost, that divides the city too much either between race or economic background. And we're not reaching out to each other to help and to see if we can't solve problems together.
Speaking of the state of the city, Mayor Sly James and the city council are having their final meetings this week and next over the city's budget, which is more than $1 billion. They'll take a final vote to adopt the budget on March 29th, and it goes into effect May 1st. The Kansas City Star's City Hall reporter Lynn Horsley has been following the negotiations since the beginning of the year. Sylvia caught up with her late last week.
It's a very difficult budget year. They had promised previously significant raises to firefighters, police, the labor unions, and also they were trying to give raises to about 1,000 people in the management and hourly ranks who have not had raises for several years. All of those raises combined would total about $18 million. And they are not seeing revenues increase by anywhere near that level. In fact, tax revenues are projected to be down slightly from the current year. So they are really struggling with how to provide the employees with raises and yet meet all the other obligations and fit it all within limited revenues.
Was there hope that we'd be coming out of the recession this year and this would be the year they'd be able to start getting those raises again?
Definitely. I think that was the expectation, was that the economy would be rebounding and there would be new growth and new revenues coming in that would accommodate the raises. And in fact, some of the council members in this workshop I was just in were expressing frustration that when they awarded these raises last year, they sort of did them independently of any budget discussions. And they were saying that going forward, they don't ever want to do that again. If they have negotiations with their labor unions, they want to tie future raises in some way to actual revenue growth. And so as we speak, the city manager's office and some lawyers and the firefighters union are in new negotiations to see if they can come to a new wage deal that would alleviate the need otherwise to lay off more than 100 firefighters.
And overall, how has this year's budget process, sort of under Mayor Sly James and City Manager Troy Schulte, compared to past years that you've been covering City Hall?
Well, in some respects, it's been less adversarial. When Mark Funkhauser was the mayor, he frequently tried to make cuts in things like the city's allocation to the stadiums to free up money for the police department. And other council members just didn't agree with those recommendations of the mayor. They felt like the city had an obligation to provide funding for the stadiums, a long-standing gentleman's agreement to provide those that increase. And so frequently there was a disagreement on the council between the mayor and other council members. That hasn't been so much a factor this year, and I think generally people feel that the city manager made good recommendations in a tough budget. It's just that the frustration is, how do you grant raises that they want to make for the employees? They really don't want the employees to have a third year without any raises. And some of those raises have already taken effect, i.e. with the firefighters. How do you do that with very limited revenue growth?
When the mayor laid out a pretty ambitious budget proposal, including this idea of investing $1 billion in infrastructure over the next 10 years, was that a surprise?
I think it was a surprise. And to be honest, there has not been a lot of discussion about that particular recommendation. That was sort of more a long-term, far-reaching vision that the mayor has. He was not so much commenting on this current year budget that's being debated. He was trying to lay out a long-term vision. I think the council agrees with the mayor that this city has huge infrastructure problems, enormous deferred maintenance problems that they need to start addressing, and possibly a way to do that is to issue $1 billion in general obligation bonds and pay for that over time with property tax increases. But those are tough decisions, and they've been kind of overshadowed by this immediate problem of what do you do about the fire department.
And at the same time, the budget still includes this $7.6 million cut to the fire department, which
right.
has been one of the most controversial issues.
Exactly. And there's even some debate over whether the overall effect to the fire department is just $7.6 million in cuts. The numbers are confusing, and I don't want to get your readers give them a headache
or give your listeners
a headache. But the fire chief contends that in fact the cut is more than $7.5 million or $7.6 million, and that in fact has severe impact on purchase of new equipment, new vehicles, fire hoses, the very things that a fire department has to have. The budget office and I think the city manager's office argue that within an overall department budget of about $100 million, the actual cut is a lot less than $7.6 million, and the fire chief should be able to manage his department with prudent cuts in other areas.
And the city manager had suggested specifically that the fire department eliminate about 100 firefighter positions.
Right, and just to put that in perspective, there are about 900 firefighters. So this is a significant cut, but it's not, you know, half the firefighters. There are disputes over how you could accomplish that. I think the city manager would like the older firefighters maybe to voluntarily retire. He thinks some of this could be achieved through attrition. I think the younger firefighters are worried that, in fact, they will be the casualties of this cut and that many of them will lose their jobs. There's just a lot of anxiety. And as I said, there are also closed negotiations going on. We are not privy to them, and so we don't know exactly what's being discussed. But there's an effort to avoid those layoffs by asking the firefighters to give back some of the raises that they had earlier been promised. Whether those negotiations will be fully finished by the time the council has to adopt a budget at the end of this month, I don't know whether those details will all be worked out, but it's possible for them to adopt a budget that allows for continuing negotiations with the labor union.
Is there a real danger that we could see a decrease in the services and effectiveness of the fire department if they go through and have to make these cuts?
The fire chief warns that that's a real possibility. Other people say that there are many fire departments in this country that operate effectively with less money per firefighter, less money per capita. We've had a pretty robustly funded fire department for a number of years. The mayor pointed out that since 2000, the city has had about 600 employees cut from non-public safety departments. And meanwhile, the public safety offices, specifically fire and police, and primarily fire, have seen their ranks increased by hundreds of employees. So the management, the city manager, many of the city council members, I think, feel that our department can operate effectively with less funding. It can operate with fewer firefighters. There are other council members and the fire chief who are very concerned about that. You know, we have a huge city. We have a lot of land to cover, and the fire stations are pretty disparately located. And I think they fear that cuts could impact response times. And if you're the person having a heart attack and the fire truck and the ambulance get to you later than they normally would, I'm sure that would be a big concern. I think everybody's hope is that there will be an accommodation reached, that the city will not have to make this level of cuts. But in order for that to happen, it's likely going to require the firefighters to accept a lower raise or even no raise this year.
And between those proposed cuts to the fire department and the idea of bringing the police into the city's health insurance plan, have relations between the mayor and the police and fire departments become really strained?
I think the relationship with the fire chief has become somewhat strained. I think on the police side, we have a new police chief. I think the mayor and the police chief are working well together. When the police chief spoke to the city council about the budget, he was pretty conciliatory. He said, we're all in this together. We need to work productively and cooperatively together. So I think there's a real hope that on the police side, there will be an accommodation. I don't yet think that the police board has signed off on the police joining the city's health insurance plan. Until that happens, the city manager is kind of putting a hammer over the police department budget by saying, I will give you $5 million for raises, but only if you join with our health department, our health insurance plan.
Now, moving to another area, what has happened to the proposed $5 million in cuts to the parks department?
Those are still in place, as far as I know, and the park board is not at all happy about that. They made an impassioned appeal to the council to restore some of that money, perhaps not all of that money. The park department would argue that in the last 5 years of this crushing recession, police and fire have pretty much been held harmless while they have absorbed devastating cuts over the years. And they said that if they had to absorb another $5 million cut this year, landscaping would be devastated, tree trimming would be devastated, it might affect the Parks Department's ability to remove snow on the boulevards and parkways. It would affect the community centers and definitely park maintenance. One argument that the park board made to the council was that we've got the All-Star Game coming in July, and they would like to show off our park system to the rest of the world and the country as a jewel in this city's crown, and they're afraid that the parks will not be looking their best if they have to absorb this level of cuts.
Any chance for changes there between now and when the budget is signed at the end of the month?
Some council members have said that if the city finds any new money or if it does get concessions on wages from the labor unions, that rather than restoring that funding to the fire department, they'd like to see some of it go back to parks and indeed some of it go to street maintenance, because the street maintenance budget is also cut by, I believe, more than $2 million. And that's on top of cuts that have already occurred in recent years. Street maintenance continues to be one of the top priorities for citizens in citizen satisfaction surveys. That's an area where citizens really want more funding, and some council members would like to restore that funding if they do get some concessions on the wages. All of this is still up in the air. As far as I know, that money has not yet been restored to parks and has not yet been restored to street maintenance. And if the budget is adopted as the city manager recommended it, citizens will definitely see a difference this year.
And you're saying that would be in parks and in street maintenance?
Sure. Now, one shining light on all of this is the fact that the city has not had to spend a whole lot of money on snow removal. But a lot of those purchases were already made. They've already purchased the salt. They've purchased some of the equipment. So that money is already out the door. However, the money that would have been spent on labor and on the cost of overtime in the event of a bad blizzard, I think that can be rolled over. It may very well just be rolled over to next year's snow removal budget. One other thing that's probably important to a lot of people is the water department budget. This new budget that's planned continues to the trend of water and sewer rate increases. And as I'm sure you've reported before, the city has underway a massive sewer overhaul to comply with environmental regulations. And we know we have a serious problem with our water lines and a record number of water main breaks. So for that, the water department is proposing an overall 14% increase in water and sewer rates. It's likely to raise the average customer bill from about $65 a month to $74 a month. And there are already people who are having problems paying their water bills now, let alone with another big increase.
What about some of the mayor's other smaller budget requests that he made in his budget letter, like having a chief innovation officer and some of the youth programs and third grade reading readiness programs?
Yes, he did request some very modest increases, and to be honest, the city council has not yet said they are going to grant those. This is normally the time when the mayor and the council start to have really hot and heavy discussions the last few weeks before the budget is adopted. And I'm sure that there will be major negotiations going on between the mayor's office and the council members to try to get support for those initiatives. These are key parts of the mayor's effort. He wants to boost efficiency. He wants to support the schools. You know, he wants to support innovation and small business. And I think he feels he needs some modest revisions to the city manager's budget recommendation to get those programs going. But as I said, the city council has not yet said they are going to honor those requests.
Busy couple of weeks for you, huh?
It will be, and we'll continue to follow this, as I'm sure you will.
Well, Lynn Horsley is City Hall reporter for the Kansas City Star. Thank you so much for your time.
Sure.
Coming up, Missouri tries its hand at caucuses. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. The path Missouri Republicans have taken in choosing a presidential nominee has been as twisty as an Ozark mountain road. The caucus phase starts in the Ozark foothills of southwest Missouri. KCUR's Frank Morris reports.
Cassville, Missouri sits in the hills near the Arkansas line. During the Civil War, the Confederate state legislature set up here briefly, and battles raged nearby. The place seems fairly placid now. The fields are green, the trees are blooming, and a cheery crowd is flocking into a gray metal building, combination community center and church, for a $10 dinner, cooked up by a stout man in a trucker-style cap named Jim Fone.
Well, we had brisket, we had pork loin, we had baked beans, potatoes, coleslaw, all kinds of pie.
And this feast, sponsored by the county GOP, is not even the main event. The Republican Presidential Caucus here Wednesday evening draws a big crowd for this town of 3,200. Organizers put out extra chairs, and David Cole, who's from Cassville, but also happens to be the Republican state chairman, runs the meeting.
As I said, this is tenfold the biggest caucus we've ever had, and we certainly appreciate the enthusiasm and welcome your participation.
It didn't take long to test that enthusiasm, though. Many here expected to vote on presidential candidates. Instead, Cole tells them they'll be voting on delegates to state and regional conventions who will, in turn, pick delegates to go to the national convention. Delegates chosen here, he admits, will not be bound to any particular candidate. What's more, he says the voting tonight will be on slates of delegates, not individuals, but groups, 28. Folks are floored. Cole's got an angry crowd on his hands.
You know, and I'm sorry that you weren't aware that was the way of the process. I apologize.
Only party insiders had seen the rules governing this caucus in advance. Frank Hubert, a robust 80-year-old in a blue blazer and tie, is one of many to stand up and vent.
What we have had happen tonight is totally unacceptable, and it is a de facto railroad job.
Turns out that county GOP officials and a group representing the Tea Party have prepared slates in advance. They're the only ones. Roberta Gray and a lot of other people are left feeling cut out of the process.
It is a little disheartening to see how a few people are still running it, and I feel like I'm lost in the commotion.
As the commotion goes on, it's clear this room is sharply divided between Tea Party supporters and the GOP faithful. Some liken it to Congress. Ralph Kelly, a retired engineer, steps out for a smoke.
I think that we should vote the Tea Party out of the Republican Party. I think they are splitting the vote, and that Obama will win as a consequence.
Tea Party folks aren't happy either.
I think it's a joke.
That's Teresa Petty.
I don't feel like we're being listened to in any way whatsoever.
Others, like Brian Anderlin, a slender white-haired rancher, head for home.
Way too complicated. Way too complicated. 258 people or more came here tonight wanting to express their voice, and they're very confused.
That feeling is well understood over in Springfield in the sunny offices of the Political Science Department at Missouri State University.
The process is chaotic. I think the one word we could use is bizarre.
For one thing, Professor George Connor says, Missouri Republicans have already voted in a presidential primary this year.
We had a primary which became a beauty contest, a million-dollar primary that didn't count for anything.
The primary last month was early and unauthorized. The National Party threatened to ding Missouri for half its delegates. So the results, Santorum won handily, didn't count. And the caucuses were organized. Well, organized might be a little strong. Connor says the rules differ from county to county.
The old joke was, I don't belong to an organized party, I'm a Democrat. I mean, I think we've turned that joke on its head here in Missouri, where even though the party establishment might be lined up behind one particular candidate, the establishment doesn't have the clout that they did 10 or 15 years ago in order to dictate the outcome.
The count for the Tea Party slate in favor is 100. Now, all of those in favor of adopting the Berry County Republican slate to the district convention, please stand.
Back at the Berry County Republican caucuses, the Berry County Republican Party manages to pull off a win over the insurgent Tea Party. That means the delegates from this steadfastly conservative town will likely back Mitt Romney. But for now, that's really anybody's guess. The winning delegates in these caucuses won't pick the actual delegates who will represent Missouri at the national convention until subsequent meetings in April and June. In fact, it may be summer before the caucuses going on this weekend and next produce any kind of winner. But despite the Byzantine nominating process and a kind of civil war going on in the Missouri GOP, Republicans in Cassville are engaged and determined to win in November. Frank Morris, KCUR News.
Missouri Governor Jay Nixon is accusing lawmakers in Jefferson City of trying to balance the state budget on the back of some of the state's neediest, blind people with limited resources. But legislators say cuts to health care for blind Missourians are needed to pay for higher education, which the governor wants to trim. KBIA's Jacob Fenston reports.
Last week, the House Budget Committee voted to eliminate a state program that covers health care for blind people whose income is too high to otherwise qualify for Medicaid. Governor Jay Nixon responded, speaking in Columbia.
These are folks that are income challenged, that have significant disabilities, that this is their lifeline for health care, and there aren't other options for them.
If I were not blind, I wouldn't qualify for Medicaid.
Jacqueline Peters was born blind.
So it's awful to say, but I'm thankful that the good Lord brought me to this life like I am.
She was one of a few dozen blind people in a crowd to hear the governor. Peters used to have a job, but now, in her golden years, survives on Social Security and the state blind pension. Not enough, she says, to pay for any kind of private insurance.
The cost of the health insurance would be so much, I wouldn't be able to pay it. So then, what good would it do me if I couldn't pay it? Then I wouldn't be able to eat or have a place to live.
I would be out on the street holding a cup, you know, trying to make ends meet. And without that medication, I would die.
Brad Manning, he's been blind for 17 years and suffers from diabetes.
I'm an insulin-dependent diabetic. I've been that all my life. That's what took my sight.
The medical bills are ongoing. He recently had a pancreas transplant and now takes anti-rejection drugs that cost thousands of dollars a month.
The doctor visits are real expensive, so is the medication.
The House budget proposal would eliminate $28 million in funding that currently pays for health care for about 2,800 blind Missourians. But Representative Ryan Silvey, who chairs the budget committee, says that would affect just 5% of blind people in the state.
And it's the 5% who have jobs and have an income. So it's not the poorest of the poor.
To qualify for the state health care, you must have less than $20,000 in assets, but there's no cap on income.
Someone could literally be making $100,000 a year, live in a home that they own themselves, and still qualify for this program as long as they didn't have over $20,000 in investment accounts or other assets.
The $28 million saved by cutting the program would go to higher education.
Since Governor Nixon took office, he's recommended cuts to higher education every year, totaling about 25% if we were to follow his original recommendation this year. We believe that that's simply unsustainable, that you can't continue to cut and cut and cut education while continuing to fund programs for people who exceed the income requirements for Medicaid.
Well, I love higher education. I'm the beneficiary of higher education. I have a college degree.
Gary Wunder is president of the National Federation of the Blind of Missouri.
All I know is that you shouldn't find the people in most need to try to get your money.
The full House will consider the cuts after lawmakers return from break next week. Governor Nixon says if the House doesn't restore funding, he'll work with the Senate to make that happen. In Columbia, I'm Jacob Fenston.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives, and we've got a podcast to find us on iTunes. The past few days have seen a national outcry over the use of lean, fine-textured beef, or pink slime, as some are calling it, in fast food and school lunches. This week, Harvest Public Media takes a look at the local meat alternative industry.
It's Harvest Public Media's Field Notes. I'm Jessica Najunas. Today in the show, Fake Meat from Missouri, and the conversation it started. Harvest Public Media recently reported this. Only 2 or 3% of people in the U.S. are vegetarian, but more than 40% of Americans aged 18 to 29 choose to eat meatless once a week. Now, the reasons for skipping meat are personal and varied: animal rights, health, taste, it could be anything, even price. The cost of beef is going way up, along with the rest of food. Researchers at the University of Missouri have developed a sort of second-generation fake chicken product. It's not just beans shaped like a burger. It's so close to the look, feel, and taste of real chicken that it might fool even the proudest backyard grill chef.
Yeah, that's the idea. It comes in these refrigerated
strips. It's soy-based.
Harvest Public Media's Jeremy Bernfeld reported last month on the Missouri-grown fake chicken.
They're trying to target people who are looking to cut down on their meat, but they like meat too much. They know what real meat tastes like. They like what real meat tastes and feels and looks like. So they're not going to spend money on something that isn't like that.
Bernfeld cooked a dinner at home using the fake chicken.
The fake meat really did look like meat that you might put in, say, a chicken Caesar wrap or something like that. It really looks like that. It's really flaky if you kind of break it in half. It has those little fibrous flakes. They have vegan chicken flavoring that they use to try to make it actually taste like chicken. I won't say that I loved it. But once I threw some barbecue sauce on it, and it was I won't say it's indistinguishable, but it could fool taste testers. I spoke with two researchers at the University of Missouri, a professor there, Dr. Fu-Hung She, and then his research scientist colleague who kind of runs his food science research lab. His name's Harold Huff, and so this is what he said about his product.
The mouthfeel and appearance in a food product sometimes is just as important as the taste. If it looks bad, people do not want to eat it. If you make it look like something they've already accepted, you've got a winner.
Right now, they're in the stage where they've got a production facility, a small production facility in Maryland, where they're kind of creating prototypes. They're hoping to start with some institutional accounts like hospitals or universities. And I talked to the CEO of the company, and he says that he's optimistic that he can even have it on grocery store shelves by the end of this year, by the end of 2012.
One of my favorite places to study food shoppers is near downtown Columbia. It's a strip mall with two very distinct choices for shopping, a health food store on one side and an affordable traditional grocer on the other. I went there to ask shoppers what they think about fake meat. The low-cost grocery store even has a meat smoker permanently holding court in the parking lot.
Yeah, that's a smoker. Chicken, ribs, stuff like that.
Its owner's just waiting for a warm week like this one to fire it up and sell some freshly cooked protein.
Libby, James.
Daniel Westrich.
Two employees from the regular grocery store lean against the side of a building to take a smoke break.
I was kind of vegetarian for a while, so that was mainly why. I'm trying to get protein. The veggie burgers and the chicken nuggets.
Nope, never will. It's just not meat. I don't know. I'd rather cut up a steak or make a hamburger for myself or something like that. I just had a huge barbecue like 2 days ago. 3 pounds of hamburger, like 4 pounds of chicken, 3 ribeye steaks, and a couple packs of like hot dogs and brats. It was delicious, you know.
It's Manahan, M-A-N-A-H-A-N. Veronica. Kind of grosses me out to touch meat. I don't like touching raw chicken and raw beef. I've done the Boca burgers and the tempeh. I really like it. My husband doesn't. I have to camouflage it. He'll eat, say, spaghetti that has what essentially is tofu instead of beef in it, not knowing. He won't know the difference, and he'll say, oh, this is really good. But if you tell him later, well, that wasn't real beef, it was tofu, then he's kind of icked out. I don't know why.
It was easy to get people to open up about their thoughts on meat, or non-meat in this case. Even one shopper with no time to chat.
How long will it take?
Like 2 minutes.
Okay.
On her way to something more important, found a few minutes to spare to talk meat.
Soy's not as healthy as we used to think it was. I'm not purchasing as much, but I'm trying to diet, and they say that's a good alternative. But I was raised on a farm, and I like beef, and I like chicken, and I like pork. I like it all, and lamb.
And the fake chicken developed in Missouri has a lot of people talking outside of the Midwest. New York Times food and cooking columnist Mark Bittman gave the Mizzou fake chicken his treatment in favor of the product with an editorial and this video.
This thing is a product that is so confident in its texture and its appearance and in its taste that it says, here we are. We are the substitute for chicken.
We're going to cut in here just as Bittman has swallowed a big bite of a fake chicken wrap.
So what is this about? What are the implications? What is the use of this? We kill nearly 8 billion chickens a year. Most of them are pumped full of antibiotics and raised in crowded, even torturous conditions. Whether you believe these chickens have souls or not, they have lives.
Anytime you can find an application where you're not using the chicken, you've made some progress. Now, some people would say, well, just eat vegetables instead. I'm fine with that. But some people want the chew, the experience, the flavor, to the extent that there is a flavor. And these substitutes are really a step in the right direction.
Then, with Bittman's blessing, the idea took off. A Mother Jones magazine blogger penned a rebuttal to Bittman's idea that anything but meat is better than meat, even if you're eating processed soy.
Okay, I'm Tom Philpott, the food and ag blogger for Mother Jones magazine, and I am the author of Fake Meat That America Could Love on MotherJones.com. You know, we've got this food culture that is very hinged on eating a little bit more than half a pound of meat a day, which is an extremely high number by global standards right now and also by historic standards. The way to get us off meat is to find really good substitutes that mimic it. When I looked at the ingredients of the product, a bunch of super processed products.
The fake chicken that Harvest, New York Times, and Mother Jones reported on contains these ingredients: water, soy, protein isolate, pea protein, amaranth, chicken flavor, carrot fiber, canola oil, titanium dioxide, and white vinegar. The average veggie burger contains much more than that list, and a whole lot of other things people tell us not to eat on a regular basis: salt, cholesterol, and saturated fat. Now, a basic hamburger has more salt, fat, and cholesterol, but a bowl of beans, rice, and veggies has a complete protein, but is pretty much naked in comparison to beef or fake chicken. So if you're looking to decrease your meat intake for whatever reason, Philpott says the fake meat product is not the healthy choice.
And, you know, the thing that I was most happy about with the Bittman article is just bringing the question up. And I think that is really important because there's no one way. We need people in laboratories where you are coming up with fake meat products, and we need people like me questioning it and saying, hey, forget about that, try beans and rice. I think having all those perspectives out there and working is a good thing. And that was kind of the purpose of my article.
That's it for Field Notes. To see a photo of the fake chicken developed by University of Missouri researchers, go to harvestpublicmedia.org.
After the break, whatever happened to Brody Buster, the child harmonica prodigy? This is Casey Kearns.
This is Casey Kearns. I'm Alex Smith, filling in for Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Mitt Romney prescribed cornflakes for Big Bird. Mizzou won the Big 12 tournament and then flamed out. And competing tax plans advanced in the Kansas legislature. KCUR's Steve Bell visits those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
A tax bill that cleared the Kansas House would cut state income tax rates. Republican Taxation Chair Richard Carlson said it's a cure for a lagging economy.
To create opportunities for small businesses to reinvest their earnings, to create new jobs throughout Kansas, to give the dignity of work to all Kansans.
Most Democrats voted against it, saying it favored businesses and well-to-do Kansans and will cost the state revenue it can't afford to lose. Meanwhile, a Senate committee amended and advanced a competing tax reduction bill endorsed by Governor Brownback. And a House committee chaired by Republican Mike O'Neill endorsed a congressional redistricting map that would put part of Wyandotte County in a district with Johnson County and part of it in one that spans the width of the state.
Every map that we do on a congressional ends up disappointing somebody.
Top Democrat Paul Davis called it gerrymandering.
It is a map that is purely drawn to help the four existing congressional incumbents get reelected for as long as they want.
A Kansas bill moving the date when first-time voter registrants must show proof of citizenship up to before the presidential election was stalled into limbo as a committee ended its last meeting without voting on it. In Jefferson City, Governor Nixon, as predicted, vetoed bills, making it harder to sue for workplace discrimination and harder to prevent workers from suing co-workers and companies in some cases of accidents and long-term occupational diseases. Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney didn't campaign in Kansas before last week's caucuses, but did make an appearance in Liberty, Missouri this week. Pitching Missouri voters, the former Massachusetts governor was selling spending cuts.
Obamacare, goodbye. Subsidies for Amtrak and for Planned Parenthood, even PBS. I like PBS, but we borrow money so that PBS doesn't have to show advertising to our kids. Big Bird's going to have to get used to Kellogg's cornflakes because we're going to have advertising or bigger donations.
Romney concentrated on criticizing President Obama and never mentioned any of his Republican rivals. The Kansas City City Council heard public comments on a proposed daytime curfew, which Councilman Scott Wagner said is not an unusual concept.
In July of 2009, over 500 cities had curfews, mostly in the evening, but of those, a fifth of them had daytime curfews.
But the committee again postponed a vote on the curfew, which is strongly opposed by parents who homeschool their kids. The council also got Major League Baseball to ease the rules on signs and vendors so that already licensed street vendors around downtown, the plaza, and the stadium can stay open in the time period around July's All-Star Game. MU ended its days in the Big 12 with a conference tournament win and 30 victories. Coach Frank Haith said he wasn't concerned that the team was not declared number one seed as the NCAA postseason schedule got underway.
That stuff will work itself out. We're not concerned with that.
And it did work itself out. On Friday, Mizzou lost to number 15 seed Norfolk State in round one and was out of the NCAA tournament. This is KCUR.
Today, at age 27, Brody Buster is a music veteran with 20 years of live music performance under his belt. As a child, he became internationally famous as a prodigy on the harmonica. But now, with a new CD entitled We'll Die Young, he's taking a giant leap away from his past. Alex Smith has this story.
There's a video of Quincy Jones' performance at the 1996 Montreux Jazz Festival. Of course, you can watch it on YouTube. Jones is leading a jazz orchestra, complete with a bunch of celebrity guest stars. As the applause for one song fades out, the band leader introduces a new guest soloist to accompany Chaka Khan, who's the group singer.
Brody Buster, Kansas City.
Then out walks a blonde, baby-faced 12-year-old. This is the most prestigious jazz festival in the world. But young Brody Buster grins and almost swaggers out onto stage while Quincy Jones chuckles. The audience politely applauds, the pianist kicks off an intro, then Brody raises his harmonica to his mouth. Quincy Jones probably dazzled a lot of unsuspecting jazz fans that night when he introduced this child prodigy, but in fact, Brody had already been working this shtick for years. When he was 7, almost as quickly as his mother handed him a harmonica, he could blow veterans off the stage. When he was 10, B.B. King declared him, in all seriousness, to be the greatest harmonica player of our time. After that came The Tonight Show, Jon Stewart, Entertainment Tonight, and tours of Europe. He moved to L.A., where he worked in the house band at B.B. King's nightclub. But when he turned 17, the bright lights started to fade.
Eventually, B.B. King's got sold, and all the house bands there got let go. And so from that was our main source of income out there, was that house gig. And, you know, ran out of money, I needed to finish high school. So I went back, and I actually graduated from Shawnee Mission Northwest.
Today, Brody Buster is an easygoing 27-year-old with a full beard and a 9-month-old son named Ziggy. The last 10 years have been a big change from the first 10 years of his career. He's been mostly working in Kansas City and neighboring towns. Brody's just as likely to play guitar as harmonica, and his voice has aged to a drawling howl not far from Greg Allman. But most importantly, he's shifted from blues to heavy rock. He says he's had plenty of reasons to make the change.
I've been playing the blues for years and years and years. I mean, since I was 7. For one, boredom, for one. For two is I got tired of playing to busy, busy places. But no, everybody was 35 years older than me. I mean, I just couldn't see myself in my 20s playing for people that are in their 50s and 60s. No offense to anybody, but really enjoying myself. I mean, part of the reason you play music is to get out there and experience things, and there's not much to experience when there's that much of an age gap between you and the audience.
Brody Buster has finally released his rock music to the CD-buying public as a new EP called We'll Die Young. This is not his first recording. He released a few discs in his blues days, but Brody Buster says he considers We'll Die Young to be his true debut.
Anything I recorded prior to this, I was a kid. I didn't even know what I was doing, and back then I was basically told what to sing and play by the other musicians in the band, and it's probably good they did, because who knows what I would have wanted to have done. But this is definitely, back then I didn't, if I wrote anything on the last albums, it was written under supervision of bluesmen and people that were in the band, everything on this I wrote on my own, this is definitely my debut record. Anything else for one of them was a live album at the Grand Emporium that even had some cover tunes on it,
Mm-hmm.
And if it were up to me, I never would have recorded those albums.
The CD, has a kind of growling rock sound, and I'm wondering, is that something that you purposely decided that you want to do, or is this just kind of more the way it comes out?
This is the way it comes out. I write the songs, and then, we jam them, and this is the way they come out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no real thought to what we're doing at all. No, there's no thought at all.
The music writer Bill Brownlee, who just wrote about this a week or two ago, he said that this was the meanest album by a local band in recent memory. What did you think about that?
Well, I mean, I took it as a compliment, but there's mixed views on this thing. A lot of people read that review and feel that the album is makes me sound like as if I'm jaded towards having success in the beginning and just doing what I'm doing now. I didn't feel the review said that. I feel like if you listen to the album, then you'd realize that he was talking about the Soons. I mean, a lot of those songs, some of them are about ex-girlfriends. Some of, there's not one song on there that has anything to do with that.
So,
I took it as a compliment. I was like, awesome. This is awesome. Yeah. There was some really good quotes. And then he said that we could take the Black Keys as lunch money. And I was like, this is the best review ever. But then my dad read it, and he's like, I don't know, Brody. I don't know about this review,
Which part of it do you think is meaner? Do you think it's the sound or it's the lyrics?
I'd say both. I mean, some of the songs are definitely angry, angry at situations like relationships or anything else that stuff like that about, The sound's definitely heavier and angry, and especially if you were going to pop that in and you were expecting, who knows, he could have popped that in and expected to hear me doing blues tunes from back in the day. If you were expecting to hear some blues and you popped that in, you'd be like, damn, that's not what I expected at all.
Brody Buster's past and the musical gifts he was born with are not things he spends a lot of time thinking about. He's mostly focused on playing new music, but Brody recognizes that his intuitive understanding of music is the foundation for what he does today. And he has mixed feelings about completely distancing himself from his early career.
Well, I mean, there's an upside to that, and there's a downside to that, too. I mean, the upside is that, I can always use that as part of my resume. I played with B.B. King, I was on The Tonight Show, blah, blah, blah. But in a lot of ways, it hasn't been good for me either, because a lot of people can't shake that novelty effect, and to some extent, some people might even come to a show of mine today and expect me to do that same thing, and they're not going to take to what we're necessarily doing. But then on the other hand, there's people that see what we're doing now and don't even know about the past, have no idea. Kids my age were just kids when that happened.
I heard an interview where you basically said everything that you play on harmonica, you were playing right from the start. Is that right?
Yeah, on the harmonica, that's for sure. I don't know why that instrument, I don't know why I can play the harmonica to this day, and I have no idea. I got really lucky, I guess. So mm-hmm. Part of me feels like maybe if I was handed something else, I would have used it to do that. But I was handed a harmonica by my mom, so that's what I. Maybe if she would have handed me a football, I would have been a football player. You never know. You never know.
So, were you able to take things that you already knew from the harmonica and use those on guitar, or was it just a totally different thing?
No, definitely, for sure. And the same goes for any instrument I play. I can play a little bit of drums, I can play a little bit of bass, but everything, I play all those instruments the same, because I can't read music, I don't really know what chord structures are, or anything like that. I'm learning, but when I started off, people would ask me what key I was in, and I would just grab the guitar where I was playing at, and so I kind of relate you know, I don't really know much about music theory or anything. So the way I play is the way I play it, I guess. So it's all kind of the same.
Do you think that still Dae Young is, you know, still influenced by the blues?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, for sure. Everything I do forever will always be influenced by the blues. I that's where I learned how to play. Everything I do from here on out will always be influenced by the blues, for sure.
Brody Buster's new CD is called We'll Dae Young. For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith.
Thanks for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at Casey Currents.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross. Alex is assistant producer. Kayla Regan and Carrie Coogan are our interns. Our theme music is by Approach, and I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.